to buy the servant, the Ammonite heard of it. It grieved them exceedingly that there had come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I rose in the night, I and some few men with me, neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me except the beast upon which I rode. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the jackal's well, and to the dung gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates were consumed with fire. Then I went to the gate of the fountain, and to the king's pool, and there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the brook or the valley, and viewed the wall, and turned back, and entered by the gate of the valley, and so returned. And the rulers knew not where I went or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest who did the work. Then said I unto them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. Then I told them of the land, of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will you rebel against the king? Then I answered them and said unto them, the God of heaven will prosper us. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. May the Lord bless to us the reading from his word this evening. Most of us in the audience tonight will be acquainted with the background to all this activity in Jerusalem. 70 years before this all took place, Nebuchadnezzar had gone up with his armies and had besieged the city and had broken down the walls and also had ruined the house of God. He didn't leave one stone upon another. And he took all the vessels from the house of God down to Babylon and put them with the vessels that he used to serve his pagan gods. The place at Jerusalem and the walls and the city had lain barren for those 70 years. But there had been a revival amongst the Jews down there. And as I mentioned, 42,625, I believe is the number, responded to the edict or to the call of King Cyrus. And they came back to build. Those that came under Zerubbabel came to build the house of God. They built an altar, then they built the house of God. And then Ezra, the book of Ezra, closes with great rejoicing in the fact that the house of the Lord had been completed. But 12 years had passed and things had deteriorated tremendously. If you read the closing chapters of Ezra, you will see once again the fickleness of the human heart. Despite the fact that God had blessed them and had enabled them to build his house, yet as human beings they were totally incapable of carrying out the worship of the living God. And later on in my talk tonight, I want to come back to these critical days in the last chapters of the book of Ezra. But that is the background. And it was into a state like this that Nehemiah came from the king. He had authority from the king. And he came back to build, not the temple this time, but build the walls and to build the city. When he arrived in Jerusalem, he rested for 3 days, it says. Were these 3 days of indolency? I guess not. Knowing the man and his character, I believe that he used these 3 days not only to recoup his strength physically, but to strengthen himself spiritually. And during those 3 days, perhaps he had the experience that the psalmist exhorts us to have: be still and know that I am God. And brethren and sisters, if there's one thing in this 20th century that we have to understand, if ever we're going to know God, then we'll have to learn what it is to be still in his presence. We're full of activity. Preachers and the Lord's servants and the Lord's people are flying everywhere, spending much more time in planes and trains and automobiles than perhaps we should. And many are deprived of the quiet time, the time when they can be still. And I believe that the ministry from our public platforms today is suffering because of the gross overactivity of some of God's servants. And so when Nehemiah came, he had 3 days in which to recoup. And there's no doubt that he was like the psalmist, as I said, that he was stilled and he learned afresh the character of God. And God imparted to him his strength for the great task before him. After Nehemiah had recovered sufficiently, he viewed the ruins of the city, and it must have been a devastating sight, a most discouraging sight. And yet it is remarkable for me to think that this great man was not deterred in purpose because of the ruinous conditions of the city. You'll notice also that he did what I count a very honorable thing. Now, most preachers are very selfish. They try to guard their own pulpits, their own platforms. But here's a man who came, and he shares his burden with a few godly men. I'm sure that these were hand-picked men. He never told them what the real intent of his purpose was, nor did he inform them that he had been given authority from the king to perform this work. But they went on a safari, so to speak, just to view the situation. And it must have been a very discouraging sight for him to go through one gate and through another gate and walk thus far on his beast, and his path being blocked and having to come back and then going down into the valley and looking up at the ruinous walls. I hope I'm impressing you, beloved, with the fact that, humanly speaking, they had given themselves an impossible task to try and rebuild the walls and to rebuild the gates of this city. It was a back-breaking task, and something which would have deterred even the strongest of men. But perhaps it is so that, in fact, as it always is, even in these days, that Nehemiah was strengthened as he shared in fellowship with those that accompanied him on that memorable midnight vigil. And I believe, brethren and sisters, and I want to stop here just for a few minutes. I believe that fellowship in prayer is the antidote for all of our spiritual ills today. And this is getting back to where we were last evening, isn't it? Where we talked to you about prayer. And I feel that the Lord is impressing me, perhaps to impress you, the importance, the absolute importance, the priority that prayer ought to have in our lives as individuals and in our lives as local churches. Prayer. There are more things, beloved, that are worked by prayer than anything else in this world. One has said that prayer moves the hand of him who moves the universe. And there is the means put in our hands and put within us to move God into action. And I believe that many of our spiritual ills that has befallen us as individuals and also as assemblies would disappear if we could have this fellowship in prayer. May I remind you of something that happened back in the Old Testament? The children of Israel were in a rather critical position. They were being assailed by their enemies, who were used to desert warfare and who were well armed. All that Israel had was a bunch of liberated slaves with very primitive weapons. They were not used to the desert and to the strategy of desert warfare. And they had reached a critical stage in their journeys. Moses realized the crisis that they had reached, and he called for Aaron and Hur. And he called for Joshua. And he says, "Joshua, I want you to take our soldiers and go into the valley and meet the enemy." And Joshua may have asked Moses, "What are you going to do?" And he says, "I'm going to take Aaron and Hur up to this mountain, and we're going to pray. Now let us go up the mountain and see actually what happened." Moses stood with his arms outstretched, and he asked God for victory for his troops in the valley. And as long as he prayed with his arms outstretched, God gave them strength, and the enemies were pushed back. But Moses' arms grew heavy, and they drooped, and immediately his hands drooped. Then the enemies began to prevail. But those two men who were with him there, they saw the problem, and they took their place with this man. They set him down on a rock, and they stood one on one side and one on the other, and supported his arms until the going down of the sun and the complete destruction of their enemies. Now, who was it that won the battle? Was it the troops in the valley, or was it the men on the mountaintop? I believe, brethren, from my reading, that it was the men on the mountaintop who won the battle, and whose prayers gave the troops in the valley strength to fight and to conquer their enemies. Oh, that we had this fellowship of prayer in our assemblies today. We so often act as individuals. And perhaps it is because we are not just sure or convinced in our hearts that prayer really moves the hand of God. And so our prayer life suffers. Beloved brethren, there are mysteries attached to prayer. And there are lessons that we have never learned relative to the power of prayer. And perhaps God is trying to teach you that last night, and perhaps tonight. May I remind you of two incidents that I read in my private reading this morning. It was the case of the widow woman with the two sons, and the creditors were about to take away her sons to pay for the debts that the family had incurred. She came to Elisha the prophet, and she told him the story. And Elisha said to her, "What have you got in the house?" And she says, "I have nothing but a cruse of oil." And Elisha said to her, "Now you go and gather all the receptacles that you can borrow. And I want you to take them into the house. And I want you and your two sons to go into the house and shut the door. And then pour out the oil. And when they went into the house, beloved, into the presence of God, and shut the door, shutting the outside world out and shutting themselves in with God, that mother poured and poured and poured until every vessel in that house was full of oil. And she said, 'Is there no more vessels?' And the son said, 'There's none, mother. We couldn't find another one.' And then the oil stopped." Beloved brethren and sisters, I believe that the time has come for us as brethren in this busy 20th century to take time out in our homes and shut the door, shut in with thee far, far above the restless world that wars below, says the poet. We seek to learn and prove thy love, thy mercy and thy grace to know. But we have to shut ourselves in. And it's when we shut ourselves in that the power comes. It's when we shut ourselves in that lives are revolutionized. I have been brought to think more and more, beloved, that reputation is formed in the stream of life, but character is formed in the presence of God. Oh, that we could see this from these Old Testament illustrations. You'll notice too that when the Shunammite's little son died, that Elisha went up into the room and he closed the door, and he was left alone with the child, possibly, but he was alone with God. And it was when the door was shut, and as he lay on that child, that God was gracious and answered his prayer. That child was given his life again. There's no substitute, beloved brethren and sisters, for waiting upon God. I don't know if you have heard this story or not, concerning the missionary who lived in the interior, and he had a long way to come to the coast for supplies and for his mail. It was every 6 months, twice a year, that he did that. And he was out on this occasion, and they felt that they should get their supplies quickly and try and reach a certain point by nightfall, because they had to pass through some dangerous territory. But rain came and impeded their way, and they had to camp right in the middle of the brigand country. They were disappointed, but they kindled their fire and they raised their little tents, and they went into the sleeping bags and began to sleep after having committed themselves to God. In the morning, just before dawn, they woke up and were thankful to the Lord for his protection, and they struck camp, and on they went on their way to the mission station. Some weeks later, a man was brought in from the jungle, and he was very, very sick, more dead than alive. And he was nursed by the missionary and his friends, and remarkably, the hand of God was upon their care, and this man began to get better. And soon he saw the prospects of leaving the mission station and going back to his friends. But he said to the missionary one day, he says, "Tell me, sir," he said, "where did you get the soldiers to guard your camp that night that you were encamped in our territory?" And the missionary said, "Soldiers?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "There were 27 well-armed guards that marched around your tent, your encampment, all that night. Had it not been for them, we would have been in and we would have robbed you." On his next visit to the coast, there was a letter in his mail, and it was from his home assembly. And it went something like this: "Did you have a problem on such and such a date? Were you in great danger, or was there something that had gone wrong, something big?" And he looked at the date and he remembered the occasion of encamping in brigand country. And listen to this. They said, "We informed the assembly, and 27 of us met to pray for your safety." 27 met to pray over in the old country, and 27 armed guards marched around that camp that night. Do you believe that? I hope you do. Because God is able, beloved friend. And if you don't think he is able, your God is too small. And we must give God credit for what he can do. Our God not only hears prayer, but thank God he answers prayer. And I think that we need to have the experience of Elisha's servant, or was it Elijah, down in Dothan. The king of Assyria said, "Who is it that's telling the king of Israel my plans? There must be a traitor here." One of the wiser captains said, "No, sir, it's the prophet Elijah. Where is he? We believe he's at Dothan. Go and find him." And under cover of darkness, the Assyrian host went down and surrounded the city. And at the crack of dawn, the prophet's servant arose, and he looked around, and he saw that the enemy was all around, and he rushed to his master, and he said, "Master, wake up quickly. Our enemies are all around us." And the prophet rose slowly, majestically, with dignity, and he lifted his eyes to heaven, and he said, "Lord God Almighty, open the eyes of this young man." And when God opened his eyes, he saw that between them and their enemies were the hosts of the Lord. You see, God is able. God is omnipotent. And these are stories from the Old Testament. And we used to tell them to the children in the Sunday school. But I tell you, brothers and sisters, we need those stories recounted to us today to show us the omnipotent power of God. How he can work in our lives. And so Nehemiah was a man of prayer. I mentioned to you that 11 times in this book we find him at prayer. He never did anything without prayer. He was a man who arrived in the city, and if it had been you or me, we would have been raring to go and getting in there with both feet and bungling the whole thing up. But Nehemiah was content to wait on the Lord for his instructions. And brethren and sisters, when we get out of the will of the Lord, are in too big a hurry, we're ended, or we're headed for disaster, spiritual disaster. The Lord said to his disciples, ere he left them, he says, on no account leave Jerusalem until you have received the promise of the Father. It would have been been spiritual chaos and disaster and a first-rate catastrophe if they had left the city without the assurance of the power and the presence of the Holy Spirit. And thank God they had the sense to wait and to abide until Pentecost. And oh, that we today would see this and would acknowledge this principle, that we would be men of prayer following Nehemiah's example, not doing anything without first consulting the God of heaven. And of course, we have other examples. I will never forget the evening while sitting with my Bible on my knee that I noticed some time ago, of course, that Daniel was reading in the book of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah prophesied that the captivity in Babylon would be for 70 years. And Daniel could remember this, because he was a prisoner now. And he realized that the 70 years was almost up. And he looked at the people of God, the people of Israel, and they were totally unprepared to go back to Jerusalem. And what did Daniel do? He fell on his knees. And he began to pray. And brothers and sisters, if there's one thing that thrills my heart, it is when I see a man of God on his knees praying with an open book before him. It's a rare sight today. There are so few who are prepared to put time into their Christianity and to allow God to form character. We're all in such a big hurry. And oh, that God would show us these principles. And as Daniel prayed, we are told that the heart of King Cyrus was moved in the palace. And he asked those of the Jews who would be ready to go back. But it was the prayer of Daniel that started the whole spiritual movement. And I am more convinced than ever, beloved brethren, that if there is a spiritual movement to begin among the assemblies of God, and how the assemblies of God need reviving, it is going to start when men of God will put time into prayer and will commit the whole question and situation to God. And there's no other way that I can see spiritual revival coming to our assemblies today. I have no doubt that Nehemiah was very concerned when he saw the ruin Can you imagine the situation? Here was the temple, the house of God, standing in the midst of this chaos. True, it had been built. But read the book of Malachi and you'll see the condition that then existed. It was atrocious. People were treating God as if he was nobody. They were withholding their tithes. They were keeping back that which was God's portion. They were offering that which was sick and lame, that which they didn't want or need. They gave it to the Lord. The priests and the Levites were not being supported and they were going back to their fields and the house of God was standing derelict, my dear friends. It was a sham. It was a shambles. And as this man of God viewed the whole scene, his heart was stirred to its depth. And from the sorrow that ensued because of that concern, there was an overwhelming desire came into his life to build up that which carnal ease and spiritual slothfulness had allowed to fall into ruin. There's a man of God standing in the midst of ruin, more determined than ever to be God's man and to go forward with God's purpose. Oh, that we had God's men in the 20th century. We are so wishy-washy. We are so unsure of ourselves. But oh, that we had men of spiritual caliber and spiritual fiber like Nehemiah. Stand up when the days are dark and to go forward with a voice and in the work of God. You'll notice too the grace of Nehemiah. He did not stand aloof from the people. He identifies himself with them. He says, "You see the distress we are in." He says, "Come and let us build." He was putting himself right where they were, and he was willing to give all the assistance that he could. And you'll notice that this is a case of total involvement. Total involvement. You know, if this truth were known today in the assemblies as it once was, our assemblies would be revolutionized overnight. Total involvement. We are having those come up among us who are bereft of the powers of responsibility. There has been no commitment to the local church, nor to the Lord. And people are able to shirk their duties and their privileges without sorrow. And our assemblies today are suffering because of this. Now there are a few young couples, and of course the young people who've come from Harrison tonight here. But in this place, and in other places that I have been recently, I would say that 90% of the audience was older people from 55 and upward. And what is going to happen to our assemblies in the future, beloved brethren? And I have a great burden for the people of God, for I love the assembly practices. I would not be here if I thought there was a better mode of worship and service. I believe that the principles that we carry out are from God. But why is it that there is a generation, not just young people in the generation, that are being raised among us who do not appreciate what men of a past generation had to lay down their lives for and suffer persecution for and lose their jobs for and be put out their homes for? And today, we just accept them in mediocrity. Oh, that God would stir the hearts of our young people, our young Christians today. I do not want to sound a prophet of doom. But, beloved brethren, there are things that we should be made aware of and become acquainted with. If the present trend continues in our assemblies in the next decade, as it has in the past decade, it is very questionable whether there will be assemblies as we know them today in 10 years' time. Things are critical, very critical, and we're like the proverbial ostrich, mostly by putting our head in the sands and will not face facts. Thank God there are a number of assemblies that I could mention to you who seem up till the present moment to have escaped the worldliness and the compromise and the disobedience that has crept in amongst God's people. Not too long ago, oh, far thousands of miles from here, my wife and myself, my daughter, my son-in-law, went to the breaking of bread in a large city. And perhaps there were 400 people at the breaking of bread, and the only two people with coverings on their head were my wife and my daughter. They are taught there that it is not necessary for sisters to wear a head cover. It was not this summer, but the summer before. I was at one of the major camps held in the southeast. And at question time one evening, there was a question in the question box addressed to me, and it read like this: Mr. Snap, is it necessary for sisters to wear a head covering at the assembly meetings? And you don't get any time to draw your breath sometimes. You just have to get up. And I went to the classic passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and I read it down, and I explained it to them to the best of my ability, and it was the chorus of amens came from the whole of that audience. But there was a full-time servant of the Lord commended by the assemblies who was very fidgety, my left-hand side. And he stood up when I sat down and he said, I hoped it would never come to this, but I have to disagree completely with what Mr. Snedden has now told you. I do not believe that it is necessary for women or for sisters to wear a head covering in the assemblies of God's people. There was just a chorus of, oh, and that is a commended worker. And beloved brethren and sisters, let me show you another thing. The devil has almost ruined our prayer meeting. In many instances, he's ruined our prayer meetings. Our prayer meetings, or many of our prayer meetings, are not real prayer meetings. They're just a matter of coming together and voicing a few words. There's no depth, there's no conviction, there's no faith. It's a matter of playing with words and tickling the ears of those who are listening. And the result is death all around. And the devil is busy. He's trying to disturb the breaking of bread And we have those among us now who said that it should be a share and care meeting. It should be a love feast, and then, as a sort of incidental, the bread should be broken. Beloved brethren, the devil is busy, and there are those in our midst who are swallowing his false teaching and his heresy. And they are tormenting and beleaguering the saints of God today. Maybe you have escaped it, but it's all around us. My heart bleeds because God has given me a burden to build and to bind and to beautify the church of God. But in order to do so, I must alert my brethren and sisters to the current conditions that prevail in the United States of America. Nehemiah was a leader. He stood head and shoulders above his fellows. He spoke with authority, and yet he spoke with love. And the people, in response to his, "Come, let us build," they responded as one man and said, "Let us rise up and build." Beautiful, isn't it? Now, what we need today, most of all, I believe, in our assemblies, are leaders. We need leaders today like nothing else. There has never been a time in assembly history when the leadership was so poor. Or we have elders. Elders by name, but not elders raised up by the Holy Spirit. But I don't know what the assemblies would do if those men who have the name of elders were to lay down the labors, because there's no one who has the concern and the interest and the zeal and who is willing to spend the time to nurture and to feed and to tend the flock of God. People want to come up here and give forth what they know from their head. It's quite easy for people to speak today. They're trained in the high schools and in our universities. It's no problem to put things together and present them in an acceptable way. But I have found in my own ministry that a message that is prepared in the head only reaches the ears of the audience. But a message that is cowled in the presence of God, in the secret of his presence, it is called down from the heart of God, and it touches the minister of the word or the preacher of the gospel, and then is delivered to the saints. That's the message that touches the hearts, and that is the message that we need today. And God is more concerned with a clean heart than with a clear head. And he says to you tonight, son, daughter, give me your heart, not your head. God is not interested in your head. He's interested in your heart. And then when he gets your heart and all your affections and gets you the whole man, then your intellect comes along behind. The more we're being educated, I'm talking now generally, the more we're being educated as a nation or as a Western culture, the farther away we're getting from God. And don't think for one moment that I will ever decry education. Never. We owe it a lot. But when we come into the spiritual sphere, it has its place. I can remember as a boy, and I was brought up in a country assembly, and most of the men were miners. Hard working, honest men. Big hands calloused. They were just as black ingrained with coal dust But these men had tender hearts. And I remember on occasions when they would stand up and read the story of the crucifixion, and oh, they made mistakes, stumbled over simple words. But you would see that big hand go up as they read the story and wipe away the tear from their eyes. Men whose hearts were touched. That's what we need today. Men with a heart for God, for Christ, for His work, for His people. We need leaders, beloved. We need spiritually qualified leaders. Paul says an elder must be without blemish to Timothy. In writing to Titus, he says twice over in the space of 3 verses, an elder must be without blemish. He must be without blemish. He must be as perfect as it is possible for a man to be. There's nothing that can be, nor a finger can be pointed at him in his character, morally or spiritually. That's the caliber of men that God needs today in the assemblies to bring them back on course and to lead them on into spiritual things. Nehemiah was a man like that. And he led his people. And then you sometimes have heard men like that speak to you with a burden in their heart and with a love in their heart. Now I remember the old days. And I've sat under the ministry in Scotland too, where if anybody had preached the way I've preached to you tonight, they would have been yelling and screaming and pounding the desk and stomping their feet, and everybody would be turned off. But I've tried to minister the same kinds of truth with a loving heart, and I know by your expressions that you're accepting it, and you believe that what I'm saying is true. And there has to be a response to ministry like this. There has to be. Because it brings brethren and sisters, especially the younger and the middle-aged, to a point of decision. It brings them to a crisis in their lives. And that crisis that comes upon them presents a great challenge. And perhaps some of you are being challenged tonight. Am I willing to lay my life on the line for Jesus Christ? Am I willing to lay my life on the line for the people of God? Am I? I remember after commissions and souls were being saved and the church was being built up and others were being affected, and they too were doing the same, and it was a happy, happy fellowship. And I remember going out the door one night and somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and I looked around and here was one of the elders, and he said, "Brother Dan," he says, "the elders want to see you." Wow, my legs turned rubbery. The elders want to see me? Oh yes, these were men of God in those days. Men of God. And the first thing that came into my mind, what have I done wrong? What have I said wrong? And that was the longest walk that ever I took from the front right down the main chapel and through to an empty room at the back. The longest walk ever I took. And I sat down there, my heart was pounding, waiting to see what these 5 men were going to say to me. And they said, "Brother Dan, we have been watching you over a period of time, and we believe that God the Spirit has given you the gift of eldership. And we this evening want to recognize His work in your life, and we invite you to come and sit with us in the oversight of this assembly." I said, Me? They said, yes, Brother Dan, after much prayer and consideration, we feel that this is the will of God. We prayed, and I sat with them for 6 months and never opened my mouth. I just listened and listened and listened and listened. And God gave me a great training. It's the modern way for the young folks to go in with both feet and make everybody spin. But I believe that the scriptural way is to sit and to wait and to listen and to learn. And I remember going to meet a friend in Glasgow the next Saturday. And we were walking down one of the busiest thoroughfares. And I said to him, oh, wait till I tell you what happened last Sunday night. And I said, the brethren have asked me to join them in oversight. And he stopped dead in that busy street. And he put his arms on my shoulder. And he looked right into my face. And he said, Brother Dan, your troubles have just begun. Your troubles have just begun. I couldn't see it. You see, I was up in the seventh heaven. I couldn't see it. But I know now, brethren and sisters, what it is to be an elder in a local church. I have tried, as the Lord has enabled me, to be a true shepherd of the flock. I have spent whole nights with erring sheep and lambs who had transgressed, seeking them for the Lord, but never been 1 minute in bed. I have cried my eyes out in my own room as I brought this one and that one and the next problem to the Lord. But I thank God for the spiritual character that it has developed in me. And I thank God for the success and the rewards that have been mine, as I have seen men recovered and retrieved for Christ. If you have two elders, thank God for them in York. Thank God for them. There's not a more maligned group of men in the Christian church today than the elders of brethren assemblies. And all that we would be given the grace to pray. In the little assembly we left in Florida, there was never a meeting. The prayer meeting on a Tuesday night in the Bible study, every brother who stood up and prayed, they said, Lord, remember our elders. Give them grace, Lord, to rule aright and to show us the way. We had a little Bible study in our home every Thursday night. And we had anything from 18 to 28 new believers in Christ. Not necessarily young people, but young converts. Some were retirees, bankers and fingerprint experts and engineers and what have you. They were all there, but young Christians. And every time they prayed for the elders of the assembly. And I believe that that was why we had wonderful success and rapport with the people in the pew because of the prayer that was offered up. All that we had young people who were interested in, and all that you could hear the voice of God, all that you could accept the challenge, all that someone here tonight would be brought face to face with the crying need of the hour. And like the Lord, lift up their eyes to God tonight. And say, not my will, but thine be done. Or like Isaiah, say, here am I, send me. Or like Paul, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Time has gone. There is so much that I wanted to say to you. But time does not permit. Perhaps I've said enough just to make you think. Will you accept the challenge? Will you consider the burden of my heart tonight that I have shared with you? Relative to assembly principles and church truths. Will you remember in your prayers those who have the rule over us? Perhaps God has touched your heart tonight and challenged you that perhaps you should be taking more to do with the assembly, the affairs of the assembly. And if there's one thing God needs today, it is dedicated, consecrated, surrendered, committed men and women. And may some of you, after tonight, be one. Those men and women. Let us pray. Perhaps it might be good at this time if we took just a little moment of quiet prayer. Maybe you have some business that you want to do with the Lord. Maybe you have heard it wrong. Perhaps you see the emptiness of your life, the frugality of your spiritual experience. It has been said to me so many times in recent days, Brother Dan, we're only playing meetings, just playing. Perhaps you have that feeling toward. Maybe you want to talk it over with the Lord.